Anitasmai Shri Guruvaye Namaha. So it's not too hot yet. So we'll see what happens as we progress through the class. And then we can take a vote if it gets too hot. We can all go swimming. Is Split hotter than this or what? Or? It's hotter than that? Okay, that's good. Is there a lake there too?
There's
steam.
Sea.
All right. No steam. Okay, so today we have a very interesting class, and we're going to try to go quickly through it. Not so much philosophy, but mostly history. And then we'll have a little demonstration of left-handed tantra today. Anyway, if anyone knows what that is, you don't want to demonstrate. Maybe you do, but anyway, I don't. So, let's start with the Puranas. The word Purana, of course, the Bhagavatam is one of the 18 major Puranas. And there's many Upa Puranas. That means younger or younger brother Purana or something like that. Like one of the words for Vamana Dev is Upendra. Upendra means the younger brother of Indra. So there's Itihasas first. Itihasa means like histories. And that's like the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. And then after that's the Puranas. So the word Purana means very, very old. And the Puranas deal with the bhakti traditions. Not only Krishna, but Ram and Lord Shiva, and even some with Shakti. Now, it's very difficult to tell the age of the Puranas. You know, some of the Western Indologists say the Puranas are 400 AD. They date back to 400 AD. But we devotees know better. How do we know better? Why do we know better? First of all, the Puranas were an oral tradition before. So the writing may date back to 400 AD. But the stories go back further. The actual form of the Puranas. As we mentioned before, language changes with time. Just like you may have Romeo and Juliet, which we mentioned the other day. And if you can put Romeo and Juliet into modern English, it's going to be a different English, but it's going to be the same story. Whereas the original four Vedas, they didn't change in their type of Sanskrit because the efficacy of the four original Vedas was based upon repeating the exact syllables, exact meter, exact rhyme, everything. Okay. So, also, and this is very interesting, in two of the oldest Upanishads, the Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad and the Chandogya Upanishad, the Puranas are mentioned. So in other words, the Upanishads are accepted as thousands of years old. So if they mention the Puranas, that means the Puranas must be at least thousands of years old, right? By logic? So, anyway, that's intelligence, and we devotees have intelligence, hopefully. Okay. So there's many, many commentaries on the Puranas. Srimad Bhagavatam has 81 commentaries on it. That's more than 10 times the commentaries and all the rest of the Puranas combined. Pretty interesting. Okay. And the Puranas also deal with history, but they deal with history presented in a certain way. The way you can tell something's a Purana is it deals with Sarga, Visarga, that means the creation, the subsequent, what happens after the creation, you know, the secondary creation, manvantaras, dynasties of rishis, dynasties of kings. So that's what distinguishes a Purana from an Itihasa. So the Bhagavat Purana means the Purana about Bhagavat. Bhagavat means about Bhagavan, Krishna. Okay, so sometimes it's questioned, you know, how old is this Krishna worship? I mean, you guys are chanting Hare Krishna. This is very interesting. So how old is this Krishna worship? We don't find that thousands of years old. You know, you see a little Vishnu or something like that here and there. But, you know, Hare Krishna, new cult. So, therefore, we have the argument that Krishna is actually mentioned in the Chandogya Upanishad, which is one of the oldest Upanishads. So, there's one proof. And remember I mentioned about that Greek ambassador, Megasthenes? Does anyone remember him? He mentions Krishna, and that was at the time of the Emperor Ashoka. You know, which is about 200 BC. Another one was really interesting. Actually, there's another interesting thing about Megasthenes. He came in contact with the Hare Krishna devotees, ISKCON, International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And he heard them chanting, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. And he misunderstood and misheard what they were saying. He thought they were chanting Heracles. You know what Heracles is? Hercules. You know, like we call in the West, Hercules. So he thought Heracles and Krishna are the same. Yeah. Anyway, so that's one point. And then 100 years before the year of our Lord, what year is that? The year of our Lord, what does that mean? 100 years B.C., trying to keep you all awake in the heat. 100 year B.C., another guy from Greece came as an ambassador. His name was Heliodorus. So what that means, Helio means what? Sun. Doris means what? Probably in your language, Doro means gold or something like that, right? Or what does it mean? Yeah, Italian is gold. It's gold. Anyway, so Doris means to adore. So he was a worshiper of the sun. So what happens? He ran into a bunch of Hare Krishna devotees and he converted. And he actually became a Hare Krishna devotee. Pretty far out. This is 100 years before Jesus Christ. He had his japa beads, came to the summer camp every summer. Shaved his head. Anyway, and had a little deity of Prabhupada. I know he didn't. I mean, I'm just, some of the things I'm just making up here, just to keep everybody awake. So, anyway, so he became a devotee, and he erected a column, a very famous column, which is called, obviously, the column of Heliodorus, which talks about Krishna and everything like that, worship of Krishna. And so when the first Christians came to India, they saw this column that predated Christ. And their minds were blown. What does that mean, to blow someone's mind? Anyone know? That means they just had a nervous breakdown. Because they had thought the name Krishna came from the name Christ. They thought, you know, you guys are worshiping Krishna because that's just derived from Christ. Anyway. So then, in other words, you see early worship of Krishna in the Vedic tradition. Okay. So next is the most exciting part of our program, which is called Tantra. Tantra. So Tantra, the word Tantra, I hate to disappoint you all. Tan means to expand, and tra in this particular context means to do it or to carry it out. So the word Tantra means to actually expand either the knowledge or the practice. That's basically what the word means. Now there's left-handed Tantra and right-handed Tantra. Now, I've got news for you. We Vaishnavas also have Tantra. Books like the Narda Pancharatra, Narda Bhakti Sutras, they're all Tantra books. Hari Bhakti Vilas is all Tantra. Yeah, the practice, it's a practice. It expands the practice. The Srimad Bhagavatam has both things. It has Vaidika information and Tantra information. In other words, the original, you know, philosophy, ontology, etc., etc. And then the practice of devotional service. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, like Prahlad Maharaj taught. Okay. And so, anyway, so this is what Tantra basically is, but we're going to get into the... We're going to get actually into the dark side. As they say in Star Wars? Yeah. The dark side of the Force. Ooh. So, it's interesting. Do any of you know French? So, what does the word gauche mean? What? It means left. But it also means in English that someone is just like, doesn't even know etiquette or anything like that. So, that means left. So the commonly understood in the Western world, unless you happen to be left-handed. That left means unusual, right? Anybody left-handed here? Uh-oh. Just like yesterday, someone was having me load a file into his computer, and I couldn't figure out how to use the mouse. And finally he explained to me, you know what a mouse is? The thing that cats like. So finally he explained to me, he reversed, because he's left-handed, he reversed the mice key, mice things. Yeah. So anyway, so this is the dark side of the Vedas we're talking about. And these are the original hippies. You know, thousands of years before we have our modern-day hippies. And they're called antinomial, which basically means they go against the rules. So the whole idea is that you become liberated if you break all the rules. And not only break all the rules, you know, just in a regular way, like, let's say if you're driving a car, you think you're liberated if you go over the speed limit, right? You know, you feel like this rush of excitement and liberation and freedom. And in America, we have these things called fuzzbusters, which means it's a radar detector you put on the dashboard of your car, and it can tell when the police are 10 kilometers away. So I'll be selling them at next summer camp to the devotees to help pay my travel expenses. Anyway, so they can pick up radar or laser detectors. Wow. It's only 100 euros I'll be charging for each one. So,
can I reserve one?
Can you reserve one? All right. Or are you going to get one from Harata? So, anyway, there's a freedom. You feel certain freedom when you go 10 kilometers over the speed limit. But when you go 100 kilometers over the speed limit, you really feel free, isn't it? So that's what antinomial means. Not just a little bit breaking, but completely breaking. And the concept, I mean, there's many ontologies involved here, is that they homologize, now that's a big word for you, the human body with the cosmos. And that means they equate, basically equate the human body with the cosmos. And they consider the cosmos, you know, has male and female principles. Of course, something like you have in China, you have this yin and the yang business. And so what they did is they actually developed means of, like, sexual expression to become liberated. And of course, I remember in the 1960s, there was this one festival called Woodstock. Any of you heard of that? The original Woodstock. I was not there. Don't worry about it. But I had some devotees I know who were there. Some of you know that one devotee, Mother Krishnapriya, was there. And what they really, I mean, for example, they were having, you know, intimate relationships with the pigs in the mud. Yuck. So this is something like Tantra. All right, now I'm going to explain what Tantra is. So the Tantras had five rules and regulations. They're called the Pancha Makara. Makara is the name for M in Sanskrit or in Hindi. Just like, there's one big company, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, the 3M company. You've heard of it? Manufactures different chemicals. They were the original ones that manufactured Scotch tape. You know what Scotch tape is? Invisible tape. And also tape for recording. 3M, very big company. So this is, we're talking about the 5M company. So they, instead of four rules and regulations, they had five rules and regulations. And so we're going to describe what they are. If you want to be a good tantric, you have to follow, you have to vow at the time of initiation to follow all five of these. The first one is maitunya, which basically means sex life. But, like I was talking about racing with your car 100 kilometers over the speed limit, it actually means, like not normal sex life, it means like at least incest, if not bestiality, and I'm not going to describe what that is. I mean, as wild as you can get, the more liberated you get. So that's the first regulative principle. That's left-handed. Yeah, we're not talking about Vaishnava Tantra. I hope I was clear about that. We're talking about the left, the dark side of the force, the dark side of the Vedas. Okay? The next one is Mamsa. Like I said, there are five M's. Mamsa means meat. That means you eat any and all types of meat. You drink the blood. You know, whatever you have to do. Just like they have all these rituals that even made their way into some aspects of modern Hinduism, where they cut the head of the goat. And the people in Fiji have told me about this. They cut the head of the goat and the blood is just like spurting out, because the blood is under pressure. We all have blood pressure, right? No? Yes. Anyway, it's under high pressure. You know, the heart is going, and when a living entity dies, the heart is still beating. Anyway, when I was young, sometimes in biology we used to, anyway, do things with animals, which we won't mention. So the heart's still beating, so it pumps out the blood, and they spurt the blood, and they drink the warm blood. And that's still done in Fiji, in parts of India. That's not exactly their tantrics, but they've amalgamated that into some Hindu practices. Or they offer the warm blood to Durga. I mean, just like you see in the Bhagavatam, that story of Jadbharata. Remember the story of Jadbharata? these dacoits had captured Jadbharata and they were getting ready to offer him to the goddess Durga and getting ready to chop his head off. And then guess what happened? What happened? What? No, who knows the story?
Durga was angry. Durga jumped from altar.
Yeah, Durga came out from the deity. And she and her associates cut the heads of all the dacoits up, and they were tipping over the bodies of the dacoits, cutting the necks off first. Just like you have a cup here. So imagine this is the head of a dacoit, or the body of a dacoit. Ah, delicious. So that's tantra. Anyway, that's mamsa. And the next one is, the next M, regulated principle, is called matsya. You should be able to guess what that means. Fish. Eat plenty of fish. Just like, you know, when I'm walking here in the morning, I see people fish. Scientists have described that a fish's ability to experience pain, its pain nervous system, is as developed as a human being. No, you hear some people say that, well, fish are all right, fish is just a water vegetable. You hear that in Bengal and in Orissa. It's true. In Orissa, you actually hear that, you know, or Bengal. It's water vegetable. But a fish experiences as much pain or more. I remember one time I was with my family and my brother. Fortunately, I never caught a fish. Thank God. But my brother caught one. And the fish was just like, you know, just like shaking on the deck of the boat. You ever seen that? Any of you ever seen a fish? Just shaking, you know, just in pain, writhing in pain. So, all right, so matcha is a very important regulative principle for all of you. The next one is mudra. Just like in Vaishnavism, we have our mudras, right? You know, blessing mudra, acharya mudra. This isn't called the acharya mudra. If you see someone doing like that, of course, it's considered impolite if you don't happen to be the acharya to point to someone. So if you're ever in front of the deities, you're not supposed to point to the deity. Just say that. You can't say that's Krishna. That's an offense. Just to let you know, you can motion that's Krishna, but no pointing. So anyway, those are mudras like that. So the point is, what's wrong with a mudra? Well, I don't want to demonstrate, but at least in America, if you're driving a car and someone cuts you off, you show a particular mudra to them. Yeah, what?
I heard that this means be religious.
Be religious. Whatever it means, in our culture, it's a mudra that's it's an insult. You have that same thing here too? Yeah. So they had, the whole idea is you were supposed to go places and make obscene signs at people. You know, whatever obscene gestures, signs, expressions you could make, you're supposed to do. That's part of being a left-handed tantric. And the last regulated principle is called mada. Mada literally means madness, but it's taken to mean intoxication. So in other words, you got to drink. And so, actually, we see a lot of the people following all five regulative principles here on the beach, isn't it? So this is a literal, let's say a drama of tantric yoga. Anyway, so remember the five next time when the guru asks you, Maitunya, Mamsa, Matsya, Mudra, and Mada. On a daily basis. Okay, and so these tantrics, they had many sexual representations and invoking like the polarity between male and female. And of course, we understand that this male-female dichotomy is originally present in Radha and Krishna in the spiritual world. So there is some like ontology in regard to the male-female dichotomy. So anyway, there were different ones. There's the Pashupatas, who would speak gibberish, make lewd, that means like the birdie to women, you know, lewd gestures to women in public. There were the Kalamakas, who would smear their face with ashes, and the crematorium rituals. There were the Kapilikas, who had a staff with a skull on top of it, and ornaments of bone and human skulls as a begging bowl. They would eat out of the human skull. Wow. Anyway, it's not something I want to follow. And they would say, here's one statement from some in the disciplic succession. Liberation consists in knowing oneself as that Supreme Lord Shiva. In other words, you're identical with that Supreme Lord Shiva. You're pure consciousness, namely the perennial vibratory pulsation between bondage and liberation, creation and destruction, having the will to become unlimited and limited, as well as the will to be liberated. Anyway, so you get it. Pretty crazy. And just one more point before we go on to the next part of our lesson, which is also extremely interesting, that when we examine the so-called bhakti approaches to Vaishnavism, compare them to the so-called bhakti approaches to Shaivism and to worship of Shakti, we'll see that only in Vaishnavism is the true concept of bhakti manifest. That is, ahaituki pratita yatmur supersedite. That means serving in an unmotivated way, undeterred way, out of love. Always with serving, for example, serving Lord Shiva, generally people want to merge and become Shiva, or they consider the impersonal Shiva. And with Shakti, they're worshipping to get power or something, some ulterior motive. Only in Vaishnavism do you find fully developed the concept of bhakti. Okay? So that was a very interesting part. Does anyone want to give us a demonstration of the five M's? No.
I have a question.
All right, you have a question about the five M's? No. It is not recommended in the Vedas. It is a deviation in the Vedas. So, what happens in India? Let me explain India, for example. India is a very diverse topography, which we spoke about in the very beginning. So, there's mountains, there's a lot of rivers, there's villages, etc., etc. So, things are very much separated. That's why you develop different languages in different parts of India. And there's complete freedom. So you actually, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. So you develop every conceivable type of religion there. And for a long time, this left-handed tantra became prominent in India. Not prominent like Vaishnavism, but, you know, prominent. And even today, even in Mayapur, sometimes you see these Nagababa. Anyone ever seen a Nagababa? In Mayapur? In Kumbh Mela, you see the Nagababas. And the devotees tell so many stories about them, how they can fly in the air at night or something like that. And oh my God, I don't know if I should tell this story. Anyway, so also by sometimes these practices, you know, black magic and things like that, they can gain some material power, but not enough to hurt the Vaishnavas. But there's stories of devotees who have been cursed by people like this, you know. But we have faith in the holy names. There's one tantric practice. Should I mention it? Anyway, I'll mention it. That a past prime minister of India followed. He would drink his own urine. That was a tantric practice. And Prabhupada commented on it. And Prabhupada said, you know, It makes the mind wicked and everything like that. So he was like the past prime minister of India. Sometimes, but Prabhupada said it was a tantric practice. I don't know about healthful for the health. I'm not going to try that. Prabhupada said it may make someone strong, but it makes someone wicked. Wicked. Okay. We could drink cow urine. That's actually very good. Anyway, so there are stories. I mean, there's black magic everywhere. Like Prabhupada talks about, you know, pisachas, bhutas, pretas, you know, witches, goblins. Like you have Putana, who is Khechari. She's not Khechari. Khechari means you can ride on a broom or up, actually a tree, not really a broom. They would take a tree with the roots, you know, and ride on it. Not that they went to the store and bought a broom, but it was a tree, and they would ride through the air in it. So they actually have things like that. I remember I was in, I don't know if I should tell these stories as part of class, but anyway, I was in South America where there's a lot of this black magic, and practically in most of the big cities, you have a witch's store or several witch's stores where you can buy shrunken heads and things like that. In Ecuador, they still have some like people who shrink heads. And so I was temple president in Venezuela. So as devotees, we go everywhere to distribute Srila Prabhupada's books, right? So they have a witch convention every year. You heard this story. And so we would go to the witch convention to distribute books. I mean, obviously. Why not? There's no police to stop us. So we go there, and the devotees, when they would walk by the witches, their bead bags... Where's my bead bag? Anyway, the bead bag would actually... The witch would be over here. The bead bag would fly in the air in the opposite direction. Like that. One time, a witch came up to touch the bead bag, and she went... Ah, and she touched, and then she went back flying through the air like 50 meters or something like that. Heavy stuff. I mean, it's still there. Oh, another time... Here's some more stories. Now that you remind me of these stupid stories. Anyway, so another time, some poor brahmachari was on Sankirtan, and someone did some sacrifice and took a lizard, you know what a lizard is? And threw it at the brahmachari, and he became attracted to the lady. And he started to follow her. This is in Brazil. And the devotees had to tackle him. You get me started telling all these stories about South America. And then another time, there was this one brahmachari in the temple, and this lady wanted to marry him. Some of you heard this story before. And so what she did is she made a little doll of him. You know, like voodoo? And she gave the doll his name, took him to bed every night, was hugging him and kissing him like that. And then one day he disappeared with her. So there are some, you know, there is a dark side of the force like that. And there is some energy like that, you know, demoniac energy or, you know, negative energy or whatever. And you got to be careful of it. But of course, wherever the holy name is chanted seriously, all these ghosts, demons, whatever, go far away. Any more questions about the dark side of the force? Satanism. Yeah, there's some similarities. There's some similarities, but basically black magic, tantric rituals. What's that?
But are there like good witches or something like that? Because I wanted to be.
Yeah. Well, if you read The Wizard of Oz, you'll see the good witches and the bad witches. You know, The Wizard of Oz? I'm sure there's good. But we just chant the holy names. And if you want, actually, if you really want to learn some powers, you can go to the Atharva Veda. You know, better find an expert first. And you learn all these mantras to be able to do things. Like the Brahmastra weapon and the... Woo! What was that? Witches always keep spiders with them anyway. One thing about witches, they always have something called a familiar. Whoops. All right, sorry to mention that. A familiar is an animal that goes along with a witch, like the cat or something like that. Like a black cat or something like that. What? Oh, crow. What? Yeah.
Because, you know, I was practicing Wicca before.
Vakka, yeah, yeah, Wicca.
And one of the main principles of Wicca is that magic is not nor good nor bad. It's about the use. If you use it for a bad purpose, then it's black magic. If you use it for a
good purpose. So you become a white witch.
Yeah, I was white.
Good, good.
I did healing stuff, herbs.
Good. So I'll speak to you later. We need some money so we can so see how expert you are.
This is gray magic.
It's Euro magic. Anyway, so, okay, enough about the dark side of the forest. Let's get into a little bit more history because we only have tomorrow and I want to cover something else tomorrow. I want to cover the Islamic tradition and its invasion of India right now. Hopefully we can get through it. Just a little bit to say about the Islamic tradition. The Islamic tradition is one of the three Abrahamic religions. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And, of course, we had those... or that tradition versus the Indian tradition, but there's another way to look at it. It's also a dogmatic approach versus a philosophical approach. Now, you all know what dogmatic means? You know, I am the prophet, and that's it. That's it. You believe in me, or you go to hell. Okay? That's dogmatic. Philosophical is there's a category of prophets. And there have been many prophets since time immemorial. And here's the quality of different prophets. They must come into cyclic succession. You know, you understand. That's philosophical. Yeah. What's a philosophical? It's not just like dogmatic. This is the only way. This is the only person. You know, everybody else is just, forget it, you know. Forget it, you go to hell. Or you're a kafir, or you're an infidel. Whatever you are. You're karmi. That's interesting. So this is a conflict right there, you know, dogmatic versus philosophical. And in addition, the Middle East... and we're talking about, you know, where Judaism, Christianity, and the Islamic tradition came from, never produced an independent, systematic philosophy. They borrowed from others. In fact, you know, the Islamic tradition borrowed very heavily from the Greeks. You know, you find the Greeks in Europe produced an independent, systematic, philosophical systems. Not necessarily religious. There were some religious overtones, you know, with, you know, the demigods and everything, like Zeus and everything. But they had philosophy. And they had logic. And they had reasoning. So that was borrowed by the Middle East. Middle Eastern people. And India also independently produced logical, philosophical systems. But the Middle East didn't. So they had to borrow from people. Okay. So here's the history, the wonderful history of the Islamic interactions with India. So the first interaction was in about 712 AD. This was not a religious war. This happened in the province of Sindh, S-I-N-D, which is present-day Pakistan. There was a shipwreck in a ship, or there was a ship coming from Saudi Arabia that was wrecked. And these people were saved and brought to the Sindh province by a king. And so the king sort of kept the people and kept all the things on the ship. You know, he thought, you know, I found some money here. And so what happened is, at that particular point, the Arabs got really upset and they attacked and they took over that particular kingdom. And that was the first, like, major interaction. So, anyway. But let's go back a little bit. Let's go back to the time of Muhammad, which happened about 100 years before that, like 570, you know, to 630 or something like that. Let's talk a little bit about Muhammad, the Islamic tradition itself. Muhammad was born in Mecca. And he was born into, let's say, a family of people who did the caravan thing. Caravan means that they were in the trade route, you know, between the east and the west. And so, and there wasn't much agriculture in Saudi Arabia at that time. I mean, I think you can understand why. There's not much you can do. You know, there were a lot of nomadic people. But the city of Mecca was really a big city because it was at the center of all the trade routes. Even if you wanted to go from east to west, west to east, you got to go through Mecca. So they became a tourist place. And to satisfy all the tourists who were going through, they had deities for everybody. They had 360 deities that they worshipped in this place called the Kaaba, which eventually was understood as the House of Abraham. Anyway, so they were making money, just like you go to Vrindavan today and they set up next to our temple in Mayapur, they sell little deity shops and everything like that, and they make money from religion. That's normal. Just like here, you walk out the door and there's people making money selling you food. Wherever there's people, there'll be businessmen. Right? That's normal. Anyway, we described the other day what businessmen mean. So in any case, so Mecca became very prominent. Muhammad was forced to leave Mecca because his opinion was that there was one God, and that sort of interfered with business. So he basically, anyway, and also he had some dreams, and the angel Gabriel appeared to him. So he went to Medina. And so Muhammad was helping run these caravans, making some money. And then he fell in love with a lady, I think she was 20 years older than him, if I remember correctly. What? She was a widow, yeah. She was a widow, and she was very rich because her husband was in charge of caravans too. So that's one of the best ways to make money is to marry someone who has money. For you men and women, you know, that's one of the things you should look at. You should look at someone's account books before you think of marriage. It's too late. Too late. Next life you should do that. But anyway. he loved her. It wasn't just like he was thinking, you know, she has a lot of money, let me marry her. Loved her. Actually, there's many poems that Muhammad wrote, love poems to this lady. So they got married. And what happened is that she naturally died before he did. Obviously, if someone's 20 years older than you, Should I use that example? Oh, yeah. Jacqueline Kennedy, after her husband died, married who? Onassis. And he died before her. And now she's dead too, but... Anyway, and she inherited all the money. So something similar happened to Muhammad. He became very wealthy. And then he became wealthier. He was always devoted to God, but he became... This is his strategy. He became wealthier by attacking all the caravans that were going back and forth. He got wealthier and stronger and stronger and stronger. Finally, as he was getting stronger, 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 wealthier, after she died, he planned how to unify all the tribes in that area. And the way he unified all the tribes in the area, he married the princesses, you know, the king or the leader of each tribe or the sultan or whatever it was called, had a daughter. And he married all these girls. And that's, even in the Vedic system, that's how kingdoms become unified sometimes, that you marry into another kingdom. And so anyway, so then he had a lot of support. And in Mecca, they were getting really worried. And they thought, we better attack him. So they went, the army from Mecca went to attack Muhammad. Muhammad had a smaller army, but by the grace of God, it's true, he won. And then later on, he was able to march into Mecca, his original city, unopposed, and basically break most of the, or if not all, of the statues inside the Kaaba. Now, there's some indication there was a picture of Krishna and Mother Yashoda in the Kaaba, too. I mean, there's many stories like that. And the Kaaba has some Sanskrit writing. I mean, devotees have written stories about that, but I've never read that in a history book. You know, it's speculation. Anyway, and so the Muhammad's, they don't like to be called Muhammadans. The members of the Islamic tradition, they regularly circumambulate the Kaaba counterclockwise. So they consider that to be the original house of Abraham. And also there was this stone, which is a Shiva Linga. Some people say it's a Shiva Linga. They were so enthusiastic when they were breaking all the deities, they also smashed that too. And that stone, actually, they put a ribbon around it and they put it back together. And when people go around the Kaaba, they touch that stone and put it to their heads. It's supposed to be something representing the original sin or Adam's fall or something like that. Okay? So that's the Muslim religion. So let's get back to India. Oh yeah, another point about the Muslim religion is that there are five basic principles everyone has to follow. There's one God, and it's Lala. Anyway, I don't remember the whole statement in Arabic. There's one God, and Allah is God, and Muhammad is his prophet. That's the first one. Second one is you have to pray 5 times daily to Mecca. Originally, it's interesting, originally the 5 times prayer was to Jerusalem. Did you know that? Then it got changed to Mecca. Then giving charity is number 3. Observing the austerities in the month of Ramadan, which means you don't eat during the day. You only eat after the sun goes down. And finally, pilgrimage once in a lifetime to the places like Mecca and Medina. It's called the Hijra. Okay. So basically their books are, the main books are the Quran and the Hadith. Quran is the what has been dictated to Muhammad, because Muhammad was illiterate, by the angel Gabriel. And the Hadith are the sayings of Muhammad. Sayings, you know Muhammad's sayings, so Muhammad Ubacha stuff. Okay, so let's see where we are now. Okay. So let's go back to the invaders of India. Now, previous to the invasions by the Islamic tradition, and people, members of the Islamic tradition, now it's getting hot, there were actually 3 other main invasions. Am I going too fast? No. There was the Greco-Bactrian invasion. That means basically a Greek invasion in 250 BC. There was another invasion called the Indo-Scythian invasion, which is 300 AD. And in that means the Persian people, basically, part of Iran. And the Huns, you remember Attila the Hun? The Huns invaded in the 5th century. But none of these people converted Hindus. They actually became converted and assimilated. What? Yeah, there was a Greek invasion. Yeah, Alexander, yeah. But they became assimilated. They didn't convert people. Now, one interesting thing is the Indo-Scythians, that means from part of Persia, who came previous to the Muslim invasions, they basically became the Rajputs. You know what a Rajput is? The people in Rajasthan, who are the most ferocious fighters in India, they actually came from parts of Persia. It's interesting, isn't it? They're not native Indians. I mean, genetically. I mean, it's mixed with native Indians genetically. Just a little bit of side history for you. Okay. Anyway, we only got 15 more minutes and then we can all go swimming. So, okay. So in the year, about the year 2000, there was this famous guy called Mohammed of Ghazni. He was actually Turkish by nature. Because remember, the Muslim world encompassed not only Saudi Arabia, but a vast section of practically, you know, Europe and Asia. There was actually Spain. You had the Moors in Spain. You had parts of North Africa, which is Moorish too. You had Iraq, Afghanistan, Persia, and the Arabian Peninsula. So, what's that? Bosnia. Yeah, Bosnia, Albania. So the Bosnians came in. So, anyways, I never heard of the Bosnians invading India. But anyway, so there was a vast, and Macedonians certainly, but there was a vast amount. Incidentally, a lot of the gypsies you had here came from because they were taken as slaves by Alexander or other people back to this area of the world. So anyway, so anyway, let's get back to Mohammed of Ghazni. He was a Turk. He was from Turkey. That's not the stuff you eat or not supposed to eat. You know, Turkey. It's one of the Americans' favorite foods is Turkey. So he was a Turk. So he came not with a religious motive, but to actually get wealth from India. India was a very wealthy country at that particular time. He was a Sunni Muslim, opposed also to Shiite Muslims. Who knows the difference between Sunni and Shiite? What?
I think that
Sunni
and Iranian.
Not necessarily. Iranians are Shiites, but what is the difference theologically? No, actually the difference is, anyone else? What?
They're impersonalists, they don't...
Not necessarily, some are personalists. The main difference is the Shiites say that, like the nephew of Muhammad, the only person who can become the leader of the Muslims is a descendant of the nephew of Muhammad. Shiites. The Sunnis, it's important to know this difference because they're in the world today, you know, this whole conflict. There's more Shiites and Sunnis that kill each other than that kill other people. And the Sunnis believe it's the assembly of Muslims who can decide who is the leaders. Of course, you know, this has to do with caliphs and everything like that, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. So Muhammad, he was a Sunni. He invaded India 17 times, and he raided India. You know, we're talking about really ferocious raids where Gujarat he went to and other states around the coast there. And he brought people back as slaves, and he sold them in Central Asia. Maybe some gypsies came from that particular juncture there. He attacked this one temple, which is known as a very famous Buddhist temple. It's called the Somnath Temple. Anyone ever heard of this temple? Somnath? In this temple in Somnath, they had a floating deity. You know, reading the history, because I researched a little bit about this last night, some people say it was a Shiva deity, some people say it was actually a full-form Shiva, or something like that. But the deity was floating in the air. Somehow or other, they with magnets or something like that. And the temple was so opulent, there was like thousands of pounds or, you know, kilos of gold, teak wood. So this this guy, Muhammad of Ghazni, came in and he destroyed 10,000 villages, took all the teak and gold. And in the year 1025, he did all this. And just one pilgrim, so-called pilgrimage, you know, pillage, he killed 50,000 people just like that, like in a few days. That's Muhammad of Ghazni. So one of his friends was a scribe. You know what a scribe is? That means he was a historian. And he wrote about what Muhammad did, Muhammad of Ghazni. And he said, Muhammad ruined the prosperity of India. In other words, India was such a prosperous country before, the richest country in the world. People wanted to go to travel to India just to get the riches of the spices and the gold and the diamonds. I mean, the British crown jewels are coming from the deities in India. You know, people think India is a poor country. Well, it's just regained its independence in 1947, you know, just trying to get back on its feet. Okay, so that's one thing. I'm just giving a brief overview. There's many, many Muslims who came in. 2 centuries later, there was a Muhammad named Muhammad of Ghor. He attacked India. He attacked Delhi. 17 times he also did the 17-time thing. He was captured 17 times. But because he was dealing with Kshatriyas, once he was captured by the king of Delhi, guess what? Does anyone know what happened? Any guesses? They released him. Yeah, you don't kill your captive king. But then he came back and he captured the king of Delhi and he killed him. No etiquette. So, at that point, he established something called the Sultanate of Delhi. And you may hear that, you know, if you go to Delhi today. And this Sultanate was under the head of all the Muslims called the Khalifa. And the Khalifa, actually the Khalifa was at that time the head of the Shiite Muslims, because this was Shiite, this other Muhammad of Ghora was actually a Shiite Muslim instead of a Sunni Muslim. So that this Khalifa was situated actually in Saudi Arabia. And so, anyway, so this Delhi Sultanate ruled for 300 years. And there's worse atrocity, too. In 1398, there was a person called Timur who killed 100,000 people in one day when he was ransacking temples. And, you know, the women were mistreated, too. So altogether between the year 1000 and the year 1500, listen to this, 80 million people were killed. That's an estimate. I mean, obviously they didn't do a census or, you know, have a computer survey or anything like that. 80 million people. I mean, they talk about the Holocaust, you know, the World War II. This is far worse. Far worse. The Hindu population of India decreased, actually. It was probably more than 80 million people killed, because the Hindu population of India decreased by 80 million. That means that's not even counting the numbers of children they had and whatever like that. So, you know, you can't really have a good estimate. But sometimes in one day, there were hundreds of thousands of people killed. And the modern scholars, they try to cover this. They say, first of all, they say there were no forcible conversions. Well, Nobody got forced to convert. It's just if you wanted to live, you converted. If you wanted to have a job, you converted. You know, if I go to you and say, you know, you're not forced, you can remain Hindu, it's fine. Do you want to keep working and making money? And you'll say, yeah. Well, we only hire Muslims here. So, you know, that's not forced, but it's... So modern scholars, in order to, you know, portray the whole thing in like a touchy-feely way, don't portray this whole episode in history very accurately. Another point is, anyone could convert to become a Muslim, but guess what happens if you want to convert to become a Hindu, or Jew, or a Christian? Does anyone know? Anywhere in the world, you're killed. It's, you know, just, you're not allowed to do it. Really heavy. Okay, now, before we end, I got a lot to present. There's a little more history. It's not that I want to present the Islamic tradition completely in a negative way. There's actually a real positive side to things, too. There was a golden age going on in beginning with the year 700 in the Islamic tradition. And this encompassed North Africa, Arabia, Iraq, Spain, and as you say, also the different parts of the Balkan area here, too. And so this golden age began when they moved the caliphate, that means the big cheese or whatever you call them, from Damascus, you know, the headquarters, from Damascus at that particular time to Iraq, you know, Baghdad. Around Baghdad, not close to Baghdad. So what this meant was that the Muslim world was no longer mainly Arab. It became more Persian at that time, because the Persians were influencing Iraq. I mean, of course, now they fight with Iraq. Anyway, it's a different thing now. So what that meant practically was that Persia, the culture of Persia, was very similar to the culture of India and also of Europe. So it was actually an Indo-European culture. It wasn't an Arabian or an Arab culture. So they had art, they had philosophy, they had architecture. I mean, it was a very cultured society in Iraq, extremely cultured. It wasn't... In fact, it was so cultured that it's described that, and so open, it's described that the Jewish people had an easier time living in Iraq at that time than they did in Spain. Why? Because in Spain at that time you had the Christians in charge, the Inquisition, you know, the Crusades, Inquisition. And so the Christians there treated the Jews as enemies. They had the Christians have this thing called a passion play. I don't know if any of you have heard of that. You know what a passion play is? That means where you show the passion of Christ. There's even a movie made of that. Yeah, Mel Gibson. Okay, the passion of Christ. So it shows the Jews being responsible for Christ's crucifixion. And that would get the Christians really angry with the Jews, and the Christians would go on what's called pogroms, not programs, pogroms. They would go and they would lynch, kill, burn, torture Jewish people as a result of that. So the Muslims had more freedom of religion than the Christians had in Spain at that time. Just a little interesting. So Persia was very sophisticated. And Persian culture at that time was like a hybrid or a mixture of what was Arab and what was Indian, what was European. And so when the Persians went to India, you got more hybrids. A lot of your Indian architecture and even your dancing, which people think is Vedic, is actually very much influenced by Persian culture. I mean, it's interesting, like the devotees now, there's some fight about the design of the Mayapur temple. And they're showing all these different designs all over India. Well, guess what? They call them Vedic. They're more a mixture of Persian culture than they are of Vedic design. Vedic design, if you want to look at a Vedic temple, you go to real South India. You've been to South India. And you'll see the temples are like the Temple of a Thousand Pillars in Srirangam or something like that. Those are the Vedic style temples. The ones with the cupolas, the things you see, generally, that's a mixture of Persian architecture. So, I mean, the whole fight of Vedic architecture is kind of funny, because if you look at the history, you'll see what people consider sometimes an ISKCON is Vedic is not actually Vedic. It may be traditional over the last 300 or 400 or 500 years. Okay. People should study history. I mean, it's really important, and I've learned a lot by studying history. Anyway, let's continue. So the golden age of the Muslim tradition lasted until the 13th century, at which time the Mughals came and destroyed Baghdad. And Baghdad, as I said, was a seat of culture, was a very beautiful city, intelligent, philosophy. So the Mughals, they came down from the north, invaded Baghdad, and of course they also became Muslims, but their mode was a little bit different than the cultured Muslims that we see before. Before that, one of the main things the Muslims would say, and listen, this is how much attached to scholarship they were. They said, the ink of a scholar is more holy than the blood of a martyr. You got that? Of a martyr. The ink of a scholar. In other words, it's more important to be a scholar than to be a martyr. It's, you know, much higher, much closer to God. And incidentally, the reason we have Greek, knowledge of Greek philosophy now, is due to the Muslims. Because they translated all that into Arabic. And previously it had all been destroyed by the wars that they had in Greece. So the Muslims actually took philosophy from different parts of the world, not independently, took philosophy from different parts of the world, brought it to Persia, translated into Arabic, and preserved, like Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, pre-Socratics, like Xenophanes and others, they preserved all that knowledge. So we owe a lot to them. Okay, so the ones who actually did the most harm in India were the ones from the Mughals. Anyway, I don't think I'll have time to finish all this today because there's a lot more information, but let's... Any questions? We can finish it tomorrow and then maybe go into the Sikhs, which are another interesting group tomorrow, and we'll end like that. But I personally find this extremely interesting, you know, what's happening in India, you know, religious history, etc. Yeah.
Can you repeat, what was the period of this genocide, 80 million people?
80 million people from the year 1000 to 1500. Roughly, that's rough, look, 500 years. Now this is not just one person. This is, you know, Muhammad of Ghazni, Muhammad of Gore. You have Aurangzeb. I mean, there's stories about Aurangzeb, which we can tell tomorrow. I mean, at least this is what they generally tell is that Aurangzeb would not eat every day until he had his weight of Brahmin threads, of Brahmins that were killed. You've heard that story, right? And many Hindus say that Aurangzeb is an incarnation of who? Does anyone know? Not Hiranyakashipu, no. Starts with a K. Kamsa. He's an incarnation. I mean, that's not from my study of history. That's what I've just run into in Braj. And he destroyed many temples. And let's get into that whole discussion tomorrow, because that involves a lot more the Mughal rule rather than just plain old Muslim stuff. It's the Mughals and their horrendous atrocities. And also, they're open-minded. Many of them were open-minded. And, you know, very egalitarian personalities. Yeah. Power of anger in people. And low culture, where they're just ready to do anything, you know, just like not caring about rules and regulations. You know, these weren't Kshatriyas. Lusty, you know, a lot of soldiers, you know, the Mughal hordes. I don't know if you've seen any of these movies. Anyone's ever seen the movies? You know, Genghis Khan and things like that. Which one? New one. Genghis Khan. You know, I mean, they were hordes. They didn't care if they got killed. You know, they just rush at you with just like, anyway, you get the idea. I think the men would understand this more than the women. What? Yeah. I've heard that too. I haven't read that part of the Vedas where it says that. If we could find the exact quote, but I've actually heard the same thing. A prediction. Yeah, I mean, it's just, it was horrendous what went on. I mean, temples destroyed, deities moved, millions of brahmanas killed. I mean, it's horrendous. I mean, it's unbelievable.
I mean, there are getting karmic reaction nowadays that the USA is invading Muslim countries for life.
Yeah, but the USA is also getting reaction that's eating cows, too. I mean, so, I mean, everybody's getting reactions.
I mean, about those Muslim,
yeah.
Invaders.
Yeah, I mean, the president's not a Muslim. I know, that's a Muslim name, but he's not Muslim. Yeah, but he's not. He's Christian. He's a Hare Krishna devotee. No, he's a devotee of Hanuman. What am I talking about? Did you know the story? You don't know the story about Barack Obama? He carries a deity of Hanuman with him in his pocket. And he said, this is, when he was running for election, he, you know, he took out all the stuff in his pocket and showed everybody what he had for good luck, and one was a deity of Hanuman. And then we knew he was going to win the election. And then all over South India, they were doing sacrifices for his success. Did you know that? They were actually doing puja and sacrifice all over South India. And it worked. And I also prayed to Govardhan, so. So it's because of me that he won the election, so. Balakarama, yeah, something like that. Anyway, whatever. But, I mean, this only for the last few years, you know, since 1947, has India actually been independent. Yeah, for the last 1,000 years, it's been a dependent country. So any other quick questions? Yeah. Yeah, there's some Purana that they were predicting. Yeah, there's some Purana that... Bhavisha Purana they were predicting. Yeah, predicting the leader of the Malechas or something like that. And Muhammad, always an interesting thing, Muhammad said about Arabia, it says, very dark and horrible place. You know, so he didn't even... He considered, you know, the culture there to be very low, and his attempts... There's something Prabhupada said. His attempts to civilize them had to mainly do with just like getting them not to be not so irreligious. Like, for example, he said, you're not allowed to like have sex with your mother or something like that. So Prabhupada said, when you have a rule like that, what does it indicate? That's what's going on. You know, if I give you a rule here, you know, you know, don't do yoga during Bhagavatam class. That means someone's doing it. So Prabhupada said, anytime you have a law like that, it indicates what activities are going on in society. So Muhammad was preaching to a very, very low class of persons there. And Prabhupada said he's a prophet of God, you know, Shaktavesh, and he was doing what he could with the people. And Jesus Christ also said, there's much I have to tell you, but you can't bear to hear. Desha Kalapatra preaching, yeah.
Have you heard about this scholar, these Islamic scholars going around challenging everyone?
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about him on the internet. He's what?
I wonder if you knew anything about him.
No, I read a little bit on the internet.
He challenged
I don't think he thinks he's defeated them. But there's so much speculation, you know, about different things. Like there's even this one devotee, Nandanandan, who writes books, you know. And, you know, I'm not saying it's, you know, it's good he's writing the books. But he's speculating about different names in Sanskrit, you know, like, what was that name? Oh, yeah, Argentina was previously where Arjuna went to. And he had children in Argentina, and he populated Argentina. You know, things like that. You know, maybe. And also, but there are certain indications of certain things. Like, for example, the Taj Mahal, which we'll talk about tomorrow. Originally, he says it was the Tejo Mahala, which means that, you know, Lord Shiva, place of worship of Lord Shiva. And if you go there, you can actually see the inscriptions of the Om and other sacred mantras on the stones inside the place. So there is some indication that the Taj Mahal was converted from a Vedic or a Lord Shiva temple to a memorial. So there are some indications, but we don't want to get too far into the speculations because it won't bring people to Krishna consciousness. You know, if I go to India and I tell people the Taj Mahal is actually a Vedic temple, they'll probably kill me anyway. It's not going to be helpful. The main thing is to get people to chant the holy names and to be able to discuss our philosophy with people. I don't want to get into the controversial things. But the history is really interesting. And another thing the Muslims did, or just let's end here, just one statement, is that they, wherever they went, they had a history of tearing down the temples, even if it was a place where Krishna appeared or Rama appeared, and building a mosque there. And later on, when people wanted to take the mosque down, they wouldn't allow that. Like they did that with Ram Janmabhoomi and Ayodhya. You know, they actually built a mosque over where Ram was supposed to have appeared. And, of course, the Hindus came and tore the mosque down, and there was later riots and everything in India about it. And now the place is completely surrounded by fences and policemen like that. And even they did that with the Jewish people. They went to Jerusalem, and the most holy place, you know, the place of the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem, they elected this, you know, temple, the mount or whatever it is up there. So wherever, this is one of their systems. Of course, the Christians also did this too. You know, the Hindus never did this. But where, or Krishna's birthplace, for example, you know, Mathura, there's a mosque there, big mosque there. And if you want to go and visit Krishna's birthplace, in Mathura, you got to get rid of your camera, anything metal on you, you know, probably your watch, your cell phone, everything like that, if you want to go in, because it's, you know, it's like a danger zone. It's like worse than going in the airport. So, because they would, that was their system, to actually try to establish a Muslim holy place wherever there was a holy place of a different religion. And they did that in India, in so many places like that. So, on the other hand, we don't want to see them as our enemies or anything like that, because the Christians did a similar thing. All the Abrahamic religions, if you read about Judaism, it's pretty heavy stuff in the Old Testament, where they went. They were leaving Egypt, going to the Promised Land, and pretty much they were told to kill every man, woman, child, and animal in every village they went through. So there's a lot of heavy stuff there too. These are the Abrahamic religions. And the reason these religions are like that is not because of the original teachings, but because of the culture in which they grew up in. You know, like if I was to try to... Oh, I don't want to say this. But anyway, if I was to try to teach religion to the monkeys, you know, they would have a certain interpretation of religion. So, yeah. Yeah, actually they're all the same family, genetically. This gets into a Bible story, I don't know if we have the time to tell it. Yeah, we have about a minute. There was Abraham. Yeah, Abraham, which Nandanandana says is Brahma, anyway. Abrahma, anyway. Abrahma Bhuvana Loka Panava. Anyway, so anyway, I'm not going to speculate. So there was Abraham, and Abraham was married to Sarah, or Sarai, depending on whether you pronounce it in Hebrew translation or English translation. And God said, you're going to have as many offspring, descendants, that are more numerable than the stars. But the problem is that Sarah was actually about 80 or 90 years old. Most ladies 80, 90 years old don't have too many children. So, therefore, Abraham thought, well, better to have a relationship with Sarah's servant, Hagar. So he had a relationship, and as a result, Ishmael was born. Okay? Then later on, by God's grace, Sarah had a kid. And so Sarah had her kid, Isaac, and then she didn't like Ishmael that much. They were kicked out, sent to the desert to wander, and Ishmael became the founding father of all the Arabs. So genetically, I mean, this is proven also by genetic research. Genetically, they're all connected, all the same family. Semitic, they're Semitic races. You understand Semitic? Like the Germans were anti-Semitic. Everybody get that? I'm also a descendant of the, you know, this body's a descendant of a Semitic race. There's certain characteristics, such as the nose and everything like that. I never had a nose job. This is a little end with a little humor. Many of the girls that I knew when I was very young, they would disappear when they were 11 years old and come back with smaller noses when they were 12. Anyway, so they didn't look Semitic anymore. So anyway, it's the same basic family, same part of the world. And as Krishna says in the Gita, very clearly, when people are following religion that's not coming from Shastra, that religion is a manifestation of whatever mode that person or those people are in. You understand? That's Krishna's explanation in the Divisions of Faith chapter, chapter 17 of the Gita. Arjuna asks him the question, when one is not following Shastra, what is one religion? And what is one's religion in goodness, passion, or ignorance? And Krishna says, depends on the modes the person's in. So, you understand? That part of the world, they were traders, or fishermen, or caravan people, you know, or something like that, camel people. And so, naturally, they were given what they could accept or what they could deal with at that point. Okay? I think we have to end now because it's time. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, just going back with what the Bhavishya Purana says, that he preached to people, outcasts, you know, people weren't. So you have a religion for people who were of a certain characteristic. I mean, just like if you were going to preach to children, you wouldn't preach to children the same way you would preach to adults. I mean, just, it's common sense. Now, everyone chant Hare Krishna. You don't tell them to control his. I've never been able to tell a child to control his senses. It's impossible. You say, chant Hare Krishna, eat some nice prasadam. Like that. You don't, you know, and telling a child to clean his hands after eating is just like, wow. Don't put your hands in your mouth. So basic principles like that. So it's the same thing when we're approaching. We also have to realize that too. When we're dealing with different cultures to actually adjust our presentation. Yeah.
Do you see that? How he dealt with different people?
Prabhupada was presenting Sanatana Dharma. I mean, obviously he adjusted the presentation according to different people, but he never turned down the volume or, you know, or gave us something that was sub-religious. You know, Prabhupada did not deal with sub-religion. He was only dealing with Paradharma, you know. Because by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy, and this involves Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who appeared 500 years ago, then even Dinahina Yata Chilo Harinamu Durilo, even us, you know. I mean, I can't say the culture I was born in was any better than that in Saudi Arabia. I mean, just like, you know, my mother, bless her heart, she would come around and get me to eat meat, and she would say, would you like some juice on your meat? Referring to, you know, blood. It was red blood. And I told everybody the story. The way I became a vegetarian is one day my mother cooked something for me. She said, today I have a special meal for you. And I said, what is it? And she said, it's tongue. So I went into the kitchen and there was this big cow's tongue about this big. And I looked at it, touched it, and I said, Mother, it's a tongue. She said, of course it's a tongue. I would never make anything canned, preserved, or unnatural for you. It's organic. And she didn't use the word organic. Because I love you, I'm your mother. And I said, that's it, I'm vegetarian. And she said, you better eat what I cook. And I said, no. And that was the end of it all. Or the beginning of it all. Anyway, so... So I mean, I can't say that that's any better than what was going on in Saudi Arabia. But by Prabhupada's mercy and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy, I mean, somehow or other. But, here's a big but. I'm not negating everything by this, but if we neglect to follow the practices of Krishna consciousness, Punarmushika Bhava, whatever we were before, or if we commit offenses against Vaishnavas, then it's back down there in the pits again. Okay. And that happens. Well, I'm basically, this is Sivan Grace, Srila Prabhupada, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.